Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll hear about a new land preservation project from Tecumseh Land Trust and Little Miami Incorporated and their partners. We'll also hear about Film Dayton's new web series and speak with the show's co-writer and more from the Antioch Writers Workshop. Today's guest, Matthew Goodman, up first. People in Ohio, Michigan, and several other states found themselves unable to use their food stamp debit cards on Saturday after a routine check by vendor Xerox Corporation resulted in a system failure. Shoppers from Maine to Oklahoma had to abandon baskets of groceries because they couldn't access their benefits. Benjamin Johnson with the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services says Ohio's cash and food assistance card payment systems went down at 11 a.m. Saturday. All states that use Xerox systems are affected by the outage. Xerox spokeswoman Karen Arena confirmed via email Saturday afternoon that some EBT systems are experiencing temporary connectivity issues. She said technical staff is addressing the issue and expects the system to be restored soon. And beginning October 21st, Job and Family Services may impose fines of up to a quarter of the total amount of unemployment benefits an individual collects through fraud. If an employer's repeated refusal to provide information about an unemployment compensation claimant results in erroneous benefits being paid, the employer could face penalties as well. Current state law requires those who commit unemployment fraud to repay the amount to which they weren't entitled and to forego benefits for a period of time. The most egregious cases can prompt criminal charges. Most commonly, people defraud the system by collecting benefits while actually working or after they have returned to a job. The Dayton Daily News reports that Ohio's student loan default rate is among the 10 highest in the country, with nearly 30,000 Ohioans defaulting on federal loans they were supposed to start repaying in 2010. According to the report, 29,500 Ohioans are among more than 600,000 former college students defaulting on student loans for the three-year period. U.S. Department of Education statistics show that Ohio's three-year default rate increased from 13.2% to 16.2%. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau reports that more than 7 million borrowers are in default on a federal or private student loan. That means they miss payments for 9 months. Defaults leave borrowers facing problems that include added interest and wage garnishment. The Tecumseh Land Trust and Little Miami Incorporated are two organizations working to preserve agricultural land, natural areas, water resources, and historic sites in Greene and Clark counties and along the Little Miami River. They recently dedicated a new nature preserve at the site where Tecumseh organized tribes in the late 1700s. To find out more about the nature preserve, I spoke with Krista McGall of Tecumseh Land Trust and Eric Partee with Little Miami, Inc.
Yeah, it's really exciting. The Tecumseh Preserve actually was already a part of a farm that was under a whole farm conservation easement. Lovely lady named Jeanette Nick approached us as her farmer, who's a lovely man who was mowing her lawn one day, gave us a call, said, Jeanette wants to talk to you about a conservation easement. She wanted to donate a conservation easement, no funding coming her way for that, in honor of her father and her brother, who had farmed that land until they both passed away. And she was just interested primarily in it remaining farmland. Her brother very much was interested in the Native American history on the property. But she basically was kind of literally holding the line on farming, on housing development coming out of Xenia. So, you know, we were delighted to talk to her, put together an easement in a very short time frame. Within a month and a half, we had the thing wrapped up. And Jeanette is still alive today, not actually living on her farm. Eventually sold the land to that farmer. And he still farms it today, along with, I think, a couple thousand other acres probably in the area. So we were happily doing our once a year monitoring visits and sending those reports off to Jeanette when we heard from Little Miami Inc.
And that was very fortuitous, I might add. We had been working with this same farmer, had got into some communication with him and his wife, and we met down on the property and were walking along the river, and we were talking about things like conservation, these voluntary conservation easements to protect the wooded riparian riverfront zones, very important to the health of the river. And he said, well, that's good. And we started to talk a little bit about dollars, and because it was going to be a purchase. And he said, well, would you be interested in actually buying the land outright? And we said, Yes, as a matter of fact. And all the stars were lining up. The funding, we had just managed to get a hold of some significant funding to be able to purchase the land and other lands along the Little Miami. And he was interested in selling, and he liked the idea of what we were going to do to restore it to native prairies. And we've planted 10,000 oaks and 45 acres of tall grass prairies seeds down there. And there's about a 17-acre wetland as part of this 82 acres in total that lines about a half a mile of the river. And we were able to close on Friday the 13th. It was a very lucky day for us on May 13th of 2011. And within 48 hours, we had 10,000 oaks planted and 45 acres of prairie planted. And we've been managing it since. And it's planting prairies sometimes in those first couple years. And the farmer mentioned this. He says, you know, it looks like a bunch of weeds down there. And he was right. But in planting and restoring and getting prairies planted, you talk to people across the country those first couple years, it does look like a bunch of weeds until the prairie grasses can finally come on and outcompete the ragweed and the other problem weeds that are down there. So that's, 2 years later, 2.5 years later, it looks beautiful down there and the grasses. And it's particularly important for water quality. It's particularly important for grassland bird habitat, one of the diminishing species or groups of species in the country, and we couldn't be happier.
Well, let's talk about the fascinating history of this land.
Well, it actually is the place where Tecumseh gathered the tribes to hold off the European invaders and did something really kind of unprecedented in bringing people together. He had a council house on the hilltop where the farmstead area still is. There's a barn very close now to where the council house was. And we've just been so excited that we've been able to be a part of protecting this area, and certainly the prairie restoration downhill a little bit from where the council house was is work towards creating a landscape that would have been more typical of mm-hmm. of Tecumseh's time. So being named Tecumseh Land Trust, it's just really a wonderful thing to see. With our conservation easements that we work with, landowners, of course, still own their land and manage their land, within some basic parameters, but, by and large, they continue to cultivate it. And so this is an interesting situation where the landowner came to us and said, well, I want to amend that easement so I can sell this land to Little Miami, Inc., who planned to, restore this wet area into a prairie and forest. And so it's very much in keeping, I think, with the vision our land trust had initially of trying to do justice by the land. The connection to the land, and specifically, I think, to the water, is something that we've had a chance to see to a small extent through Native American eyes. Occasionally, we've been visited by some of the Shawnee tribes that have been interested in kind of retracing their family roots, the back east to where their families came from. And the water, the fascination with the water, more so than Tecumseh's specific history, mm-hmm. Has really struck me when I've had a chance to interact with these folks. And I think they've somehow have been almost a little surprised at how excited we've been to have a chance to connect to them. They might think that, most non-native people are interested mostly in development for some reason, but we've just been so excited to have a chance to host them. And there are a couple of groups that have participated in this dedication. And so that's, just so exciting to have these opportunities to connect with them. And it's all, just want to emphasize again, it's all voluntary. I mean, here's this landowner, this combination of organizations, it's all because we love this land, we want to honor it, and including the Little Miami, through which Tecumseh traveled extremely rapidly again and again. It astounds me when I read these accounts, and I think of how forested the land was. But the Native Americans were just so adept at using those river highways to get around.
And back then, as you say, Krista, there was this whole part of the Little Miami watershed from basically Xenia on north towards Springfield was an oak savanna. So there were extensive prairies, extensive wetlands, extensive oak forests, all of which was pretty much intact in the days of Tecumseh and 200-plus years ago. So when we look at restoring properties and preserves along the Little Miami, we go back to those original Ohio vegetation maps and say, well, what was here? What were the early surveyors that came in 200 years ago? Because they're taking pretty good notes on what they're finding. Because in part because they're tying their surveys to, you know, a large oak, 24-inch oak tree over here and a stone over here. And, of course, we don't do that anymore. But they had some great notes in their files of what was there. And that's what we've tried to recreate and restore to its natural state.
Well, you answered my question. I wanted to know how easy or difficult was it to determine the historic context or topography of the land.
I wouldn't say it's easy, but with enough research, you can track that down and through these historic notes and historic accounts from a variety of sources. So this is one of about we have several other prairies. That we've restored through Green and Southern Clark County, and they're all taking you back to the day when you can just stand there and imagine what things were like back 200 years ago, and it's really sort of our ability to do that and our responsibility really to do that for future generations to be able to tell our grandkids and show our grandkids, not only tell them but show our grandkids what the world is like in its natural state and let them come to appreciate it.
There's opportunities, by the way, for volunteers to participate with either of our organizations to help with some of those restorations. I know our conservation easement project on Glen Helen Nature Preserve has been a really big effort of ours recently, and we're looking forward to getting that one wrapped up within just a few months. And there's been just some fantastic restoration opportunities there, and we've been a part of that. Sometimes we also will help our private landowners who would like to restore some of their areas, and particularly along the waterways, to more of its historic kind of native state. And that means we remove a lot of non-native plants in order to get there, generally speaking. And what is amazing to see, and we're really seeing that just on a couple walks I was on in the Glen last week, there's actually a nearly miraculous kind of seed bank of understory plants, of wildflowers that come to life once that honeysuckle is gone. So it's, you know, a lot of the threats to our natural world, of course, people have introduced kind of wrongheadedly along the way, planting the wrong things or not really understanding the needs of a particular kind of ecosystem. And so it's, you know, we'd really urge listeners who want to get involved to look up both of our organizations. And there's probably volunteer opportunities within just a few miles of your home. That's one of the great things about being a land trust and working with great partners like Eric and his organization, is that we really try to share the information. We not only want to make a good world for the next generation, we want to help the next generation get to know that world and help make it better for their kids. And so we've been doing a lot of what we call new stewards activities, and that's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. Get kids out on the land. And I think young families really are looking for those opportunities for their kids. They've got the values. They don't have a whole lot of time, but we're really trying to work on opportunities to get people out. Both of us have newsletters. All people need to do is just email to get in touch, and they can find out about activities that are going on. We're both nonprofit organizations, and our volunteers are what keep us going.
Getting people outside, getting kids outdoors is a big challenge ahead, and for obvious reasons. You know, they get busy doing other things and lose track of the fact that they, through in large part because of a lot of the efforts of Tecumseh Land Trust and Little Miami Inc., these habitats are getting restored, and the bald eagles are back. The great blue herons are out there. And we want to see, like I did growing up on a farm up in northwest Ohio, hiking back in our little 12 acres of woods, red-headed woodpeckers, you know, and those kinds of birds and other wildlife that I think the young people, you know, they're the future stewards of our world. And We really do them a disservice if we don't do our best to introduce them to the beauty that's out there.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with Krista McGall with Tecumseh Land Trust and Eric Partee with Little Miami Incorporated. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
Recently, Film Dayton launched its first web series. Freak Club was filmed in the Miami Valley and put together by local cast and crew. Film Dayton says Freak Club offers intrigue, witty dialogue, ghost stories, and lots of fun. Freak Club was an extension of their educational programming and matched professional and aspiring filmmakers together. Co-creator and co-writer of the series, Alexandra Grzynski, is a Springboro native and University of Dayton engineering grad. She's now a writer living and working in L.A. She told me how Freak Club was born.
So I won a competition actually in November of 2011, and the organization is a nonprofit called Film Dayton, and they called for treatment. I submitted one. A colleague of mine, Amanda Miller, who's a local actress, she pitched it to them. I was in a musical at the time, and we won. So what ended up happening, what I won was six of my episodes would be developed with professional writers, local to the Dayton area also, and been produced. I'm so excited. I'm excited to see what people think, what people's reactions are. If they want to watch, they can go to Freak Club web series on Facebook, or they can go to the Film Dayton website at filmdayton.com, and there's a Freak Club thing they can click on and watch the episodes.
Did you have any hesitations entering this or any questions as you submitted your work?
You know, I actually had the idea like probably 6 months before I submitted the idea to Film Dayton, and it was just, I just happened to go to a Film Connections meeting that they have on the last Tuesday of every month, and where they were accepting treatments, and I just thought it was fate. So I just, you know, went for it. And did I have hesitations? Not really. I just felt like it was too good to be true, and it wasn't. And sometimes I find that sometimes things just fall in your lap, and that was one of those instances, and I just did it, I believe. Went in full force, so.
Well, let's talk about your submission.
Mm-hmm. It's called Freak Club. It's basically about a group of eccentric people from the Dayton area. It's based in Dayton. They are trying to, there's two high school kids are trying to form a paranormal society in Dayton. And they're calling it Dayton Paranormal Society. But they're not so popular at school. And so what ends up happening is they get affectionately referred to as Freak Club by the kids at the school, hence the title of the web series, Freak Club. And it just so happens that a popular girl has a few paranormal experiences of her own. And so that sort of kicks off our story as to how we're kind of getting this group together in the first six episodes.
So you wrote six episodes of these, correct?
Six episodes, it's about half a season, yeah.
Okay. And future plans for the rest of the season?
Well, right now, I mean, like, we'd have to get funding. So hopefully we can put a trailer together and get some people interested to fund the other six episodes that would make a full season.
All right. So this is a web series. And tell me about the challenges of putting this together.
Oh, gosh. Well, it took about 2 years. And the challenges, I mean, it's like any other production process, I feel like, you know, it's all the challenges of, like, finding the right people to do the job, the work that you need to do. When we were doing production, I mean, I was involved in every aspect of the process, and my writing partner did a lot of facilitating of the post-production. And it's just there's so many little things that have to be done that you don't even realize. Like, I never realized it had to be done when you're making a film. So everything from feeding the crew, you know, it's such a huge thing. And you didn't, you know, when I started this, I didn't even know about that. And I mean, it's a huge expense to feed a crew, like when you're in production, and you know, this is a little thing that you don't think about when you're not involved in film production, you know.
You mentioned the challenge of funding for the next round of episodes.
Yeah.
How did you fund the first six?
Well, we had a lot of generous donors. A couple people who were in the series, their family donated money. Nicole and I did a lot of funding. Film Dayton did a lot of fundraising. There were some people in the local area who donated their time and services. I mean, it was a community effort, no doubt.
You mentioned some benefits and life changes for you as a result of this. Can you talk about those?
Oh my gosh, where do I start? When I was doing this, so I actually graduated from the University of Dayton in chemical engineering. I went on to try a few different things to find my passion, and I was, at the time, I was actually acting and trying to get in. I just knew I wanted to sort of work in film. I didn't know totally in what aspect. So what ended up happening is I ended up falling in love with writing, and I realized that I've always been a writer. So I've actually since moved to L.A. and am trying to get my stuff made, screenwriting and fiction writing. So I'm doing a little bit of both.
I've been speaking with Alexandra Grzynski. Her new screenplay, Freak Club, will be a part of the Film Dayton web series launching Thursday. Alex, thanks so much for speaking with us.
I really appreciate speaking with you. Thank you so much.
You can watch episodes of Freak Club on the Film Dayton website, filmdayton.com. On this Sunday morning, we continue our series of faculty readings from this summer's Antioch Writers Workshop with Matthew Goodman from his latest book, 80 Days. He begins by giving some background about this book's subject, Nellie Bly.
I live in Brooklyn, not far from the site of the old Nellie Bly amusement park. So I lived for many years metaphorically in the shadow of Nellie Bly. And I'm still living today, in a sense, in her shadow. Nellie Bly was this amazing, audacious, courageous, difficult journalist, female journalist in the 1880s, who was an undercover investigative reporter for Joseph Pulitzer's newspaper, The World. And in 1889, she decided that she was going to go around the world faster than anyone had ever done it before to try to beat in real life the mark of 80 days set by Phileas Fogg in Jules Verne's novel. So she went to her editors and she proposed it, and they said, no, absolutely not. This was a time, of course, when male newspaper editors didn't even like their female reporters to go across the city unchaperoned, and Nellie Bly was saying, I'm going to go around the world by myself. And they said to her, quote, only a man can do this, and she responded by saying, very well, you send your man, and I will start for some other paper, and I will beat him. And that's the way that Nellie Bly was. And, of course, part of the reason they said no was that, you know, the idea was that a woman going around the world would have to take 11 steamer trunks to carry all the ball gowns and the various accoutrements that she would need for such a trip. And so Nellie Bly said, I will carry everything I need in one handbag, which she did for this 2.5-month trip. And that actual bag is now on display in Washington, D.C. at the museum, and it is tiny. It's very moving, actually, to see. So I'm going to read a section from this, 80 Days. This is Nellie Bly on her first ocean voyage, leaving New York for England on the Augusta Victoria steamship. Bly's first attack of seasickness had occurred within minutes of the ship setting out, and her physical discomfort had been made far worse by the fear that she might be sick for the 70 days of her journey to be spent on the water. It was a reasonable enough concern. She had, after all, never been on a long sea voyage, and so had not developed her sea legs, the tolerance to a boat's rocking motion that seemed to build up over time, like a violinist's callus, inuring one to future discomfort. Moreover, it was widely known that women suffered more than men from seasickness, a misery that, like the pains of labor, could never be adequately communicated to those who had not experienced it. The sufferer was liable to feel at once freezing and feverish, unable to sit up without a sickening nausea. Even the softest and most innocuous sounds, a creak of a floorboard, the lapping of the waves, reverberated inside the head as loudly and unnervingly as the yowl of an alley cat. The wretchedness of the condition was perhaps best conveyed by the old saying that those suffering from seasickness believe they will die on the first day, are sure they will on the second, and hope they will on the third. After her first voyage to Europe, Harriet Beecher Stowe had written, I wonder that people who wanted to break the souls of heroes and martyrs never thought of sending them to sea and keeping them a little seasick. Worse still, one could not be sure how long an attack would last, nor that any of the proffered remedies would actually lessen its agonies, for even after millennia of human travel on the water, little was known about the malady's prevention or cure. Those afflicted were variously instructed to lie down and to stand up, to rest and to exercise, to seek out darkness and light. They were advised to drink champagne, port, brandy, rum, or salt water. The latter treatment, it was admitted, quote, makes the drinker very miserable for a few minutes. To eat chicken, oysters, celery, marmalade, hot West Indian pickles, or to eat nothing at all. In his practical treatise on seasickness, 1880, Dr. George M. Beard suggested chloral hydrate, more popularly known as knockout drops, though he cautioned that it was not recommended for daily use. Lunch was served on the Augusta Victoria at 1 o'clock. On the first day, still weak from her earlier attack of seasickness, Bligh made her way to the first-class passengers' dining hall in the ship's deckhouse. It was a large room decorated in a Rococo style that the industry journal The Marine Engineer graciously termed mixed Renaissance. Overhead arched a canopy of stained glass. There were bronze statues, gilded mirrors, intricately painted panels done by the best artists of the German school. Stewards in full dress and white gloves moved noiselessly about, seeming to anticipate passengers' needs before they were spoken. A group of musicians, the stewards of the second class hall, a dining hall, hired in part for their musical skills, played an overture for the passengers as they arrived. As an honored guest, Bligh was seated at the captain's table in the armchair directly to his left. Soon the captain himself, handsome and bearded, took his place at the head of the table. The waiters ladled out the soup. Bligh discovered that she had an overwhelming desire not to see, smell, or taste food, at least until they had reached land. The passengers began to introduce themselves. To Bligh's embarrassment, the others at the table turned out to be old hands at ocean crossings, and she thought she saw indulgent smiles on all their faces when feeling another attack coming on. She put a handkerchief over her mouth and did her best to excuse herself politely from the table. "Miss Bligh," said Captain Albers, "you must come back every time." One of the stewards helped her to a secluded spot on the deck where again she was sick. Back inside the dining room, she was greeted with a hearty round of congratulations for her fortitude. "The only way to conquer seasickness is by forcing oneself to eat," the captain noted approvingly. But the bravos of her table mates only made her more conscious of her precarious condition. And when the fish course was placed before her, she felt her stomach start to turn, and choking behind her handkerchief, she was forced to excuse herself to the deck for a second time. Bligh, though, had made up her mind that she could not afford to be seasick, that she would heed as long as she could the captain's advice to keep coming back to the table. And so, like a boxer who returns to the center of the ring after having been knocked down, she returned again on unsteady legs to the warmth and murmur of the dining room. She was aware now that every unexpected sensation, the flare of a light, a food's aroma, even the expression on someone's face, could by itself bring on a new wave of nausea. The band still played its distressing tunes. She did her best to focus on the story the captain was telling. Once she caught the eye of a waiter who seemed to be watching her with an amused gleam in his eye. Again, Bligh felt sick, and for the third time, blindly, despairingly, she rushed out of the dining room. Staggering once more back inside, she now felt that she had already passed over to the third stage of seasickness, in which one hopes for death. Her head was on fire, but her hands and feet seemed to be encased in ice. She tried to keep as still as possible. She felt she could scarcely remember a time when moving had not been a misery. The courses arrived in seemingly endless succession. She spoke little and ate less, and it was all she could do when at last the final course had been served to mumble that the meal had been very good and then excuse herself and head wobblingly back to her cabin, where she crawled into bed and almost immediately fell asleep. She slept all through the night. Later, she would recall some dim, awful dream and waking up once to take a few sips of tea, but beyond this, all was oblivion, until she heard a voice calling her name. Opening her eyes, she found a stewardess and one of the female passengers in her cabin, and Captain Albers standing at the door. "We were afraid that you were dead," he said jovially. "I always sleep late in the morning," she said, in as apologetic a tone as she could muster. "In the morning," exclaimed the captain with a laugh, "it is 4:30 in the afternoon." "But never mind," he added, "as long as you slept well, it will do you good. Now get up and see if you can't eat a big dinner." Feeling half-drugged with sleep, Bly pulled herself out of bed and drank a cup of tea. When she went back up on deck, she found, to her great relief, that she felt perfectly well, and at dinner that evening, she did not miss a course. Thank you very much.
Matthew Goodman from his latest book, 80 Days. More from the Antioch Writers Workshop next Sunday morning on WISO Weekend. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO. Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.